You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Friday, September 23rd, the feast day of St. Pius of Pietrelcina, more popularly known as Padre Pio. St. Padre Pio. Pray for us, and I hope we have a good day together today. Certainly do my best to get it started well. Got the second hour, my guest in studio, Jason Hall, my good friend and the executive director of the Catholic Conference of Kentucky. It's going to be in the house during the second hour, and we'll be talking about a number of things, including a very penetrating article by Sister Teresa Alethea Noble, who's been a guest on this program before, but she wrote an article on signs of a toxic faith, five signs of a toxic faith, signs that your faith has become a corrosive, in a sense. So we'll talk about that a little bit, as well as an interesting article from Emma Green in The Atlantic about Catholics in the political world and whether or not political survival depends upon one being a so-called cafeteria Catholic. If you've never heard that term, a cafeteria Catholic is someone who basically goes past the sneeze shields of the Catholic buffet and sees all the different dishes out there representing various Catholic teachings and picks and choose dishes that they like and dishes that they don't like. They're selective, let's just say, in their embrace of Catholic teaching. So we'll talk about that next hour. You know, kind of like if I went through a buffet, hypothetically speaking, by the way, I try to steer clear of buffets because, quite frankly, I don't need to eat all I can eat. But I'm going to gravitate toward fried things, which is not a good thing. Things with gravy. I'm not going to gravitate toward the broccoli. Maybe the lima beans if they've been cooked in bacon grease. That's just me. Anyway, and we have the same tendency sometimes as Catholics to pick and choose what we want, and Emma Green speculating that in today's political climate, that may be the only way politically to survive. So we'll talk about that with Jason in the next hour. We may talk a little baseball, too. I mean, it is getting to be that time of year. October is around the bend, though you couldn't tell it from the heat outside. Other things that I want to talk about on the program today, and of course, we'll spend the Dollar Catechism. We'll give out our What Were You Thinking awards and so forth. But I want to talk about the latest from Charlotte, of course, an update from the goings-on there. Also, the Old Testament's House of Cards and the very interesting rise of Christian satire with sites like Eye of the Tiber in the Catholic world, the Babylon Bee in the evangelical world, and why I think that's a good thing. So all that and more. Certainly welcome your calls anytime during the program today. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a response or a thought to Facebook or Twitter. Really excited today. I get to play golf this afternoon. I mean, I have not played golf in like 2 years. I hope my clubs are still in the trunk of my car. But I get to go be a part of a four-person scramble. Our diocese, Catholic Diocese, which is my full-time employer, has a benefit golf tournament every year. And somebody asked me to play on their foursome, which is always a little bit of a dangerous thing because typically the foursomes that I have played on in this diocesan golf tournament in the past have a fine tradition of coming in last. Now, the whole idea of a scramble, if you're unfamiliar with golf, right, is you have four golfers and you all tee off, hit your drive to start the hole, and whichever is the best of the four, everybody else picks up their ball, and you drop your ball at that spot for your next shot, and then repeat, lather, rinse, repeat. Everybody hits, take the best shot, so forth. So you would imagine if you've got at least one or two decent golfers in the mix, that you could shoot some really good scores. And typically, the winning scores in these type of scrambles border on the ridiculous, something like 20 under par. My teams typically have come in at about 10 over par. I mean, we can barely play a little bit better than bogey golf with four of us. And the problem is because, you know, usually foursomes have an A player, somebody who's just really good, kind of a ringer, a B player maybe, a C player, and a D player. Teams I've been on, we've typically been four D players. And the only reason we're D players is because there's no such thing as an E. I might be something along the line of an N player. But anyway, I digress. It'll be fun nonetheless, no matter which place we come in. So definitely looking forward to that. As I said, today the feast day of St. Padre Pio. This is from Catholic culture. Born in 1887 in the small Italian village of Pietralcina, he joined the Capuchin friars, the Capuchins, a branch of the Franciscans. Archbishop Charles Chaput, for example, up in Philadelphia. Father Raniero Cantalamessa, who is the papal preacher, that's right, preaches to the Pope and to the Curia at least twice a year. How'd you like that job? Also Capuchins. That's where cappuccino coffee comes from, by the way. Anyway, he joined the Capuchin friars at the age of 16, was ordained a priest 7 years later. For 50 years at the monastery of San Giovanni Rotondo, he was a much sought-after spiritual advisor, confessor, and intercessor whose life was devoted to the Eucharist and prayer. Yet despite such notoriety, he would often say, "I only want to be a poor friar who prays." St. Padre Pio, known for his penetrating gaze, among other things, particularly in the confessional. It was said he could stare into your soul, and if you didn't confess it, you better come clean. All in, of course, the spirit of fraternal or paternal, let's say, correction. Of course, he was someone who received the stigmata, the wounds of Christ, at a certain point in his life. It's really, you know, one of the only persons, really, or few persons in recent history, photographically documented, for example, to have the stigmata. I remember when I was not Catholic and I was reading something about the stigmata. I mean, it's a fascinating subject. I remember a friend of mine who was a Methodist was reading a book about it. And it talked in this article that I read long before I was Catholic about Padre Pio, who died, back in the early 70s. And, 1968 is when he died. And I'll never forget at the end of this article, which was from a secular source on the stigmata, at the very end of the article, it simply said, "Science has never been able to fully explain the stigmata." Boom. And that was it. So pretty remarkable. Maybe we'll talk a little bit more about St. Padre Pio next hour with Jason Hall when he's on the program. His heart, by the way, in Boston, or has been in Boston, not sure if it's still there. Again, part of this Catholic understanding of relics and the sanctity of the Holy Ones, and which goes back all the way, actually even before the time of Christ, but certainly magnified through Christ and then the season of the saints, the idea that there is a special sanctity in those things associated with saints, and they can become sources of grace for us as well. Believing in the communion of saints, the sharing of in holy things as we do. Had an interesting conversation with my class yesterday at school. We are, of course, I'm teaching the book of Genesis, the whole Old Testament. We're in the book of Genesis right now, and I end up spending about a month on the book of Genesis because it's so foundational, and it really opens up a window into Scripture in a necessary way, I think. To really understand Genesis is to understand our origins, not just our origins as a human species, of course, but our origins as Gentiles, even grafted into what God was doing and is doing in the Jewish project. And so to read the book of Genesis is to gain a deeper understanding. And the book of Genesis is a fascinating book anyway. So much personality there. As I've said before, circumstances change. our cultural context may change, human nature does not change. As I quoted Leon Cass in his book, The Beginning of Wisdom, about the book of Genesis, Genesis doesn't just tell us what once happened. Genesis tells us what always happens, so to speak. And yesterday I had my students read the account of Jacob's deception of his father Isaac. His father Isaac, of course, failing in eyesight in his old age. Isaac, in chapter 27, calls his older son Esau and says to him, "My son," and he answers, "Here I am." And then Isaac goes on and asks him to take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, and go out and hunt game for me, prepare for me savory food that I love, and bring it to me that I may eat it and that I may bless you before I die. The power of that paternal blessing on the firstborn son, very rich in the ancient Near East and certainly a rich part of the progeny of families, and particularly here among the patriarchs and the lineage of God's covenant people, Isaac wanting to bless his son Esau. So he sends him out. Esau was a hunter, to go out and hunt, to bring back a savory dish, and so that Isaac could bless him. Now that's where the story takes an interesting turn, and what I'll explain a little bit later in this hour is that this story, very much like the house of cards of biblical stories, and I'll explain what I mean maybe at the bottom of the hour when we get back into this. Love it. It's such good human drama. We'll be back with more. This is the Mike Allen Show. Question of the day coming up on the other side of the break. You're listening to Redbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Check out Breadbox Media, all of our various contributors at breadboxmedia.com. Listen to podcasts through Google Play, iTunes, or Podbean. Become a friend of your favorite show, like this one, through a monthly contribution and receive access to exclusive online content. Check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. Question of the day. Always looking at things that happened on this day in history. And on this day, back in 1962, was the premiere of The Jetsons. You know, meet George Jetson. His boy, Elroy. I still know the song by heart. Anyway, so my question is, I think it was like the first animated cartoon, maybe primetime or something, to be on TV. I can't remember, but something like that. But I'm asking the question, what was your favorite animated television series of all time? Probably if you tell me that, I'll be able to maybe determine your generic or your general age range. If you tell me what was your favorite greatest animated series of all time. Of course, I grew up in a little bit of a golden age when we had the best of the past. Stuff like Tom and Jerry and Looney Tunes and so forth. I mean, to me, it begins and ends with Looney Tunes. I mean, come on. But then you also had, you know, newer stuff like Scooby-Doo and so forth. So, of course, The Jetsons, not too old. I was born in 66. It debuted in 62. So Saturday mornings, that was chief cartoon time. It's before you had things like the Cartoon Network, for example. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. 573-4-BREAD-4, your favorite animated television series. 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Of course, cartoons used to be exclusively the domain of children. And that was, of course, before things like Family Guy, you know, Beavis and Butthead back in the day, King of the Hill. And I guess it all started really with The Simpsons in terms of bringing more adult themes to animated shows. I have to admit a certain fondness at times for The Simpsons. Yes, it is in some ways inappropriate. But think about the Simpson family. They do go to church. A lot of TV families don't. Reverend Lovejoy, their little church there, they are dedicated to one another. Yes, Homer's the worst of the TV depictions of the father as a clueless oaf. But maybe I'm tempered a bit in a criticism of The Simpsons by the outstanding episode where Bart and Homer were both toying with becoming Catholic. Did you ever see that one? Bart gets kicked out of school. He ends up in the local Catholic school. He meets a hip Irish priest, no stereotypes, of course, and is given a martyr comic book with all kind of gore and violence in it. Marge and Homer, though, not suspicious until one night when they say the blessing for dinner. See, Simpsons say the prayer at dinner. Anyway, so they ask Bart to say the prayer. It's his turn to say the prayer for dinner, and he begins, In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiriti Sancti, making the sign of the cross. Homer storms off down to the church, pounds on the door. The Irish priest comes out. Homer's ready to berate him for trying to convert his son, and the Irish priest says, I'll be happy to talk to you, Mr. Simpson. It's my Irish. Pretty bad, I know. I'll be happy to talk to you right after our pancake supper. And, of course, then Homer falls to his knees and says, Pancake supper? You turned breakfast into dinner. It's a miracle. And Homer, for a while, toyed with converting. Very troubling to Marge until she was very troubled by the fact that her pastor said there were different afterlives for Catholics than for Protestants, and she has this amazing vision of Catholic heaven and Protestant heaven. It is priceless. I'm just telling you right now, you got to see it. Anyway, so how about you? I'd love to hear from you. Your favorite animated series ever. I had this website pulled up here, Ranker, which is sort of a grassroots, you know, democratically voting website on a whole bunch of different issues, and they have the greatest animated series ever listed in their top five, but for some reason I've got some sort of a glitch here. I can't get it to come up, so I'll have to tell you about it later. We have gotten few responses to this question. Oh, here we go. Number one, they've got Looney Tunes, no-brainer. Number two, they've got The Simpsons. Number three, they've got South Park. Now, that's a show I've never watched, taking irreverent to a whole new level, I believe. Number four, Futurama. Again, not my age demographic. Number five, Tom and Jerry. Number six, Scooby-Doo. Number seven, Batman, the animated series. Number eight, The Flintstones. Number nine, Avatar, The Last Airbender. Okay. And number 10, Family Guy. And SpongeBob checking in at number 11. So, responses I've got, and you're certainly free to respond via Facebook or Twitter, Mike Allen Show, the handle. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Got to vote for the Jetsons. Well, I'll have to share those a little bit with you later. Sports news. Let's get to that really quick. Of course, if Patriot haters, and I count myself among the Legion, if Patriot haters were hoping that New England would dig a hole for themselves before Tom Brady's return in triumph after his four-game suspension, how's that working out for you? Now down to his third-string quarterback, rookie Jacoby Brissett, New England last night hanging a 27-0 shutout on the Houston Texans and their vaunted defense. With a rookie quarterback who threw for only about 100 yards. I mean, like I said, the whole question that has, you know, been an NFL conversation for years, did Brady make Belichick or did Belichick make Brady? I would say right now, the Belichick made Brady camp is feeling pretty good about themselves for the Pats to be now 3-0 without the aforementioned Brady and really doing it with nobody great taking snaps. So pretty remarkable. Much as I can't, I have to tip my hat to the greatest coach in the NFL, maybe the greatest coach in NFL history. Big college football games this weekend. Let's say you got Georgia at Ole Miss. We'll find out whether the Kirby Smart hire at Georgia. They flirted with losing at Missouri. We'll see. Mark Richt has Miami going. So if Kirby Smart stumbles and Mark Richt continues, I guess he'll be getting the last laugh in that whole deal. Wisconsin at Michigan State, big game in the Big Can't Count Conference, otherwise known as the Big Ten. Let's see, Florida at Tennessee. I like Tennessee to win that game. Florida's blowout of my Kentucky Wildcats notwithstanding, I just don't think they're all that good. This isn't quite as good a weekend in terms of big-time matchups as you had last week in Arkansas versus Texas A&M. That'll be an interesting game, both ranked in the top 20. Let's see, NFL matchups coming up this weekend. Let's see here. In the great league of parity, you've got Arizona at Buffalo. That should be no problem for the Cardinals. Oakland and Tennessee could be dicey. Let's see, Detroit at Green Bay. Both teams 1-1 and in need of a win. Denver at Cincinnati. Let's see. Any big ones here that I can see? Pittsburgh at Philadelphia. Both teams 2-0. Carson Wentz, rookie starting for the Eagles. We'll find out whether Philadelphia's early season surge is for real. And then you got the Bears playing at Dallas. And Atlanta at New Orleans. Is it my imagination that's Monday night? In my imagination are the Monday night matchups here early in the season kind of anemic? Maybe it's just me. Anyway, all right, let's move on to our What Were You Thinking nominees of the day. We've got a few spanning the globe as we do to find examples of human beings not putting their best thinking foot forward. Came across this story of a woman held hostage by a seagull. Now, it's nothing to laugh about, right? Angry seagulls hold woman hostage for 3 days. This is not a kind of story that I like to read about. Evidently, this woman went out to take out the garbage, and she found herself surrounded by seagulls. She got attacked by one. She noticed herself bleeding. She went back in the house, and she's so intimidating by these winged creatures that she stayed in her house for 3 days before she could finally, in a fit of courage, race to the car and go get someone to help her. Now, I tell that account. This comes a story out of Great Britain. 80-year-old woman who said she felt like a prisoner in her home. I guess she wouldn't have to hang her washing out. Wow, people still hang their washing out. That's when she was attacked by the seagull. She was finally able to get out. Let's see. The thing that I know I wanted to mention about this, because I'm not giving the What Were You Thinking award to the woman, because bless her heart, she suffered through enough. I'm giving it actually to my wife, because whenever we go out to the beach, my wife likes to actually attract seagulls. She starts feeding little pieces of crackers. And you know why she does that? Because she knows that I'm scared of them. Maybe I saw the birds at too young of an age. But when I get surrounded by seagulls on the beach, it freaks me out. So this is the proof I need to my wife. What were you thinking? Attracting large crowds of seagulls. Those birds are mean. We'll be back with more. The nominee and the winner, says the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We're right at the bottom of the hour back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media on this feast day of St. Padre Pio. St. Padre Pio, pray for us. Pray for my wife, Angie. She is this weekend, left last night. Going to be a little rough sledding around the Allen house without her there, but she left for the weekend to be part of an axe retreat. Not sharpening axes, based on the book of Acts from the New Testament. And I think it's some sort of an acronym like Adoration, Confession, Thanksgiving. It's a sort of something like maybe Curcio, for example, or you know, other spiritual retreats you may be aware of. It's a women's Acts retreat, and she'll leave. She left last night. She'll be back on Sunday. So pray for her and the other participants in the retreat, because that they'll gain a blessing from it. So, and pray that she comes home safely to her husband, who misses her terribly. Again, my question of the day, what is your favorite animated television series ever? 573-4BREAD-4, this on the 54th anniversary of the Jetsons premiere on television. 573-4BREAD-4, you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com, or you can post your thought on Facebook or on Twitter. And as soon as I get things to come up right on my laptop, I'll share you a couple of responses we've gotten on Facebook and on Twitter. Anyway, back to our What Were You Thinking awards. We have given one nominee. Let's give another one. This out of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Again, spanning the globe, finding the worst in human thinking. How about this story? A new law which allows drivers to go through some red lights went into effect across Pennsylvania on Sunday. Act 101, more commonly known as Ride on Red Law, gives anyone on the road the option to go through red lights as long as they use common sense and caution. Exactly. Common sense and caution. Now, here's my point, okay? I'm giving the second nomination to these legislators. Yes, I understand the dilemma. Believe me, we've all done that. Sort of a middle of the night sort of thing. You come up to a light. No one's coming in either direction for a long, long time, and yet you still have to sit there red. And how many of us, show of hands, please, have decided after a little while to finally, maybe you didn't trip the signal, whatever, you just decided to go ahead and run the red light rather than wait 3 or 4 minutes for it to run its cycle, though no one was coming and it was the middle of the night. I've done it. You've done it, I'm sure. Whatever. Do we really want to that's just common sense. Do we really want to put a law on the books that tells people, as long as you use common sense and caution, red lights are optional? Essentially, if a stoplight is unresponsive, the bill says, and no one is coming the other way, the new law, sponsored by Representative Stephen Bloom, someone can legally drive through the intersection. Quote, it's a common sense piece of legislation to solve a practical problem when a signal doesn't detect a small vehicle, motorcycle, or even a horse and buggy. Common sense, brother. We don't need legislation. Anyway, that's what I'm saying. So I can see it now. Believe me, drivers here locally where I live already consider the red light, especially on a left turn signal, to be optional. Anyway, but the winner of the What Were You Thinking Award of the Day, we're going to go straight to academia. That's the irony of this, isn't it? Go dumb or go home, as we say. This story, new research may have debunked the 5-second rule. Ah, yes, the famed 5-second rule, the story says. That's the age-old scientific theorem that says if you're at, say, Comerica Park in Detroit and you drop your hot dog on the floor, that you have a 5 count to pick it up and eat it before it goes bad. Well, it turns out whoever came up with this rule is a quack, because a pair of researchers from Rutgers University in New Jersey just turned it on its head. Now, wait a minute. Do these researchers think that they're actually people who believe the 5-second rule is a real thing? I mean, if you are out there and you actually thought the 5-second rule was a legitimate scientific theory, by the way, in my house, it's like a 30-second rule, if not a little even more open-ended than that. I mean, I've eaten a French fry from underneath my car seat before a week later, okay? So we have to expand the 5-second rule. But did we really have to spend research money to debunk something that everybody says as a joke anyway? Because let's face it, they just want to eat the food, and they're not going to let a little thing like dropping it on the floor spoil it. Evidently, these researchers went the extra mile, testing the potential for cross-contamination from services like stainless steel, tile, wood, and carpeted flooring to foods such as watermelon, buttered bread, and gummy bears. Each was tested not only for 5 seconds, but a host of other times. Guess what? They found out that contamination happens much more quickly. I'm still going to eat it, just so you know. So really, you had to pour money into a research because you think people actually believe the 5-7. Maybe they do. I don't know. That's your winner, ladies and gentlemen. 5734BREAD4, if you've got a nominee from your own life, would love to hear about it. 5734BREAD4, you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. I want to get back to what I was talking about with my class, my Old Testament class, the one class I teach at the local Catholic high school. I love to do sort of little thought experiments with them. We're in the book of Genesis right now, kind of waist deep in the book. I'm going to have a test at the end of next week. I spend a disproportionate amount of time in the book because I think it's so foundational to our understanding of the Old Testament and salvation history and all the rest. Plus, I love the stories in Genesis about these families because it does give you hope that if God can use these persons as his elect, if the golden thread of redemption can stay tied in the midst of such human dysfunction. I mean, look at the patriarchs. Their families put the fun in dysfunction, no doubt. One thing I had them do the other day was sum up a biblical story in 10 tweets, you know, trying to make it as in their world as possible. And so I had the story of in Genesis 16 of Abram's wife Sarai. Of course, they would become Abraham and Sarah, but Abram's wife Sarai coming up with this brilliant plan since God hadn't given them a son for Abram to sleep with her maidservant Hagar. Those things always end well and with predictable results in Genesis 16. And then I had other groups tweet out chapter 17, which is Abram and doing his part of the covenant and circumcising himself and all his descendant or his, you know, his son and his servants and all the rest. They were even putting some hashtags in there like hashtag ouch and that sort of thing on the circumcision angle. But anyway, what I had them do was read 27, the story of Jacob fooling his father Isaac, getting his brother's blessing. I had them rank the characters 1 through 4 in terms of their moral virtue. In other words, number 1 on the list would be the most virtuous. Number 4 would be the most corrupt. And so you go from there. And I had them read this passage in Genesis chapter 27, where Isaac, who is in his old age, he can't see well, he sends Esau, his older son, out to get some game, to prepare him a meal, and to come back and give his blessing. Rebekah, Isaac's wife, and the mother of these twins, Esau and Jacob, was listening. She overheard it. And so when Esau went out to hunt, Jacob, who was not a hunter but sort of a homebody, she pulled Jacob aside, her favorite, and she had him prepare a goat, take it to his father, wearing something of Esau's and putting the goat skin on his arms, Esau being rather hairy, and fooling his father into thinking he was blessing Esau when in fact he was blessing Jacob. Again, Jacob is the one whose name would later be changed to Israel. So, you know, you read this story of this deception, and then Esau, of course, when he discovers what has happened after Isaac blesses Jacob, and Esau is so stricken with grief and then rage, and he wants to kill Jacob, and Jacob has to flee. So I have them rank these characters 1 through 4 in the order of virtue, and I have to say, it's a tough story to read. It's sort of like, you know, ever since I finally powered my way through binge watching all of Breaking Bad, which in my book is probably the greatest television series ever put together. Now, it's A little rough on the sensibilities, if you are of the tender variety, but it is a powerful depiction of the slide of a nominally good person into great darkness. So I was looking for another series, and I thought, I've heard about this House of Cards. Maybe I'll watch that. I watched one episode of House of Cards, which is a political drama set in D.C., Kevin Spacey, Robin Wright. And I was so, after after watching one episode, it was like, there's not a redeeming character in this show. Unless something changes, I don't see how anyone could enjoy this show, because you look for some little sliver of virtue, at least I do, that you can hang your hat on. Now, it wasn't easy to find in Breaking Bad, I'll admit, until finally I determined by the end of that series that the one little light of virtue, believe it or not, was in the young man Jesse Pinkman. I didn't find one in House of Cards, and from what I understand, there is none to be found. It's a little bit like this passage that I had my students evaluate. When we come back from the break, I'll tell you who they listed as the most virtuous, and may surprise you who they found as the least virtuous in this story. We'll be back in a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show on this feast of St. Pius of Pietrasina, more popularly known as St. Padre Pio. Be joined here in the studio in just a little bit, top of the next hour, by my good friend Jason Hall. I'm going to talk about When Faith Turns Toxic, a little article from a frequent guest, Sister Teresa Alethea Noble. We'll be talking about that a little bit on the program today, as well as whether or not political survival depends upon cafeteria Catholicism. Keeping an eye on the news with things going on in Charlotte. Got a friend who lives there and a niece who's in school there. So I've been keeping a close eye on this, on the protests after the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott. Fortunately, last night, the becoming much more peaceful, the protests last night. And after the protests went over to a shooting that took place among the protesters, I guess, the victim, Justin Carr. So fortunately, things last night, a little bit more peaceful. There's still calls for a release of the video of the shooting, the claims by Charlotte police, of course, that Lamont Scott or Keith Lamont Scott was carrying a gun. Others have said he had a school book in his hand picking up his child at school. I understand that you don't want to in any way hinder the investigation, but you wonder, are they going to have to release this tape? Because simply saying, trust us, the evidence shows he was holding a gun, right now is not going to hold much water. And if the video evidence is insufficient, or even worse, if it contradicts what the police chief is saying, then things could get quite explosive. And this also has the potential to metastasize into some other places as well. We have some real issues, some obvious consistent concerns across communities nationwide that they really have to be addressed. And these sorts of explosive protests, until that happens, I think, are unfortunately going to continue. But to the president urging calm, and others, of course, and evidently, there have been racial tensions in Charlotte in the past, this exacerbating it. So we'll keep an eye on that as it unfolds. Back to my class for just a minute. And this, as I say, this sort of House of Cards passage in the book of Genesis, House of Cards being the Netflix show that I only got through one episode of because I couldn't find a redeeming character in it. Maybe I should have waited it out. It's a little bit like this in Genesis chapter 27, the story of course, Jacob and Esau, a rivalry from in utero. That's what my students noticed yesterday. I was so glad to see them picking up on these kind of connections. They said, gee, sibling rivalry is a real problem between brothers in Genesis. I was like, bingo. You know, you've got Cain and Abel, of course. You've got the brothers who are the sons of Noah. Ham ends up becoming cursed, of course, and his descendants. You've got Isaac and Ishmael. And now you've got Jacob and Esau. Esau born first. Jacob, the name allegedly connected to his grabbing the heel of his brother. And of course, you have that scene a little later at a younger age when Esau came in from the field famished. Jacob had some stew. Again, Esau was the outdoorsman, the hunter. Jacob was the homebody. He comes in, sees the stew, ends up giving his birthright, selling his birthright to Jacob just to feed his stomach. Esau never accused of being the brightest bulb in the pack in these stories. But anyway, so I had my students rank the four characters in chapter 27, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, and Esau, in terms of their level of moral virtue, one being the best person in the story, four being the worst person in the story. Well, the best person in this story, they surmise to be Isaac. Isaac, because he was blind, is really the victim here. Isaac, who simply wanted to bless his son and could be forgiven in his old age of confusing the two sons and granting the blessing to the other. So he came out unanimously as the most virtuous character, even though Isaac had his own issues, which he got from his father. He became a bit of a deceiver. If you'll recall, even his father Abraham once or twice lied about who Sarah was, saying that she was his sister so that she would be taken into a harem of the local ruler without himself being threatened. Isaac did the same thing. So there's a little pattern here. But anyway, the class voted pretty strongly and clearly that the least virtuous person in the story was not Jacob, not the one who fooled his father, the heel grabber, in fact, not simply in utero. They voted hands down that Rebekah was the worst person in the story, the mother who sort of contrived this whole plot and engaged her son in it. So they put her down fourth, and then Jacob was the just above her. Though there were those who were a little down on Esau because, of course, he was angry and wanted to kill his brother. Again, sort of like the Cain-Abel deal. But anyway, so what one of the interesting things about that whole event is that it had been prophesied in chapter 25, the older shall serve the younger, was the prophecy that came with the pregnancy of Rebekah with these two twins. And of course, that would end up playing itself out and Jacob would become the lineage. Another young man in my class noted that there seems to be, in some ways, the elevation of the younger son throughout the book of Genesis. Cain, the older son, Abel, the younger son, right? And you go on down from there, of course, Ishmael born before Isaac. But Isaac is the son of promise. You have Jacob elevated above Esau. And of course, you would have Joseph way down the line elevated above his brothers. So that's the when I see that, those light bulbs going on and kids beginning to see these connections, because the book of Genesis is so richly written. As I said, the powerful thing as you go through Genesis, because as I said, you know, there's another actor beyond these four in this story. It's, in fact, the chief protagonist in the book of Genesis. Do you know who the main character in the book of Genesis is? It's God himself. God is the key character in the book of Genesis. He's the one, in a sense, writing the story. That doesn't in any way displace human freedom. Human freedom is real as well as the consequences. But God is the one acting, and it's in fact God who creates. It's God who is with Joseph later when he finds himself in his lowest point. It's God who appears to Jacob even as he flees his brother in the vision at Bethel with the staircase or the ladder going from earth to heaven and back again. It's God who's at work holding this whole project together. If you'll recall, after the fall, Genesis 3, it didn't take long before things had so spiraled that God, who created and saw everything good, by the time we get to chapter 6, sees only wickedness in the human heart and wants to be done with his project, regrets having made humanity, but he finds in one person, Noah, hope. Noah, the one man of virtue. And so God's plan to save Noah and his family and wipe everything else out and a remnant of the animal species and to rebuild. And it's amazing these parallels you see between creation and the new creation coming after the flood. It's almost as if God is doing a do-over. But with all the promise and hope that comes with the elect family emerging from the ark after the destruction, it quickly descends as well to where Noah's drunk and naked in his tent. One of his sons exposes him. There's a curse that comes down. The family's divided, and you spiral down all the way to the Tower of Babel and human ego and ambition seeking to make a name for themselves until their languages are divided. So no matter, you know, it's sort of like humanity is no matter where you go, there you are. You can start all over, but you still got the same fallen material. And so God starts a new project. Now, it's not like God had to learn by trial and error. That's sort of there for our benefit. But the new project is it's going to be through the patriarchs, the very imperfect patriarchs. Not chosen, it's very clear, not chosen because of their virtue. Chosen because of God's own sovereign will. And that's the interesting thing about Genesis. This ancient book, you would think the Jews would clean up some of these details about their ancestors, but they don't. They leave it all there, all of Jacob's stuff there for you to see. But the beautiful thing is it's a reminder again of its believability and the fact that God chose them purely by his grace, not because of their virtue. Let's real quick make a run through history, the last part of this segment here, September 23rd through the ages. What are some other things that happened? Augustus Caesar, born on this day, the first Roman emperor, died, of course, in 14 A.D. 1642, Harvard College in Cambridge, Massachusetts, had its first commencement, very much rooted in the Christian faith, believe it or not. And this day, 210 years ago, Lewis and Clark returned to St. Louis from their Pacific Northwest trip. That's an Undaunted Courage, great book about their adventures. Let's see, jazz saxophonist John Coltrane would be 90, born in Hamlet, North Carolina. Ray Charles would be 86. Julio Iglesias still around, though, 73. It's one of the girls I've loved before. Bruce Springsteen, 67 years old today. The Boss, Jason Alexander, better known as George Costanza, is 57 today. And The Shawshank Redemption, starring Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman, Andy Dufresne, premiered on this day in 1994. We'll be back with more. This is the Mike Allen Show. Jason Hall coming up the second hour. Don't go anywhere. This is Breadbox Media.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.